120,000 ethnic Armenians. The most recent high-profile flare-up was in September 2020, and that was, you know, an all-out war which lasted for 2 months before a tripartite peace agreement was brokered, in which the territory would be ceded by Armenia to Azerbaijan, and Russia would be in charge of monitoring the last remaining road between Armenia and Azerbaijan, which is known as the Lachin Corridor. For the past 6 months, Azerbaijan has been subjecting Artsakh to an absolutely grinding boycott of sorts. No goods can enter the country. There are the basic medical supplies are inaccessible. Food is running out, and there is no sign of the international community in any of this. The government of Armenia itself has been rather quiet. Surprisingly, perhaps because they fear all-out war again with the assistance of Turkey and perhaps, yes, Israel.
Well, David, I mean, these agricultural links between the Zionists and Azerbaijan seem to replicate the kind of strategies that they've used elsewhere, don't they?
Well, they do. I mean, when you see some of the photos of these villages, I mean, they look from the air very much like Israeli settlements. Mm. And actually, they're seen by the Azerbaijani government as settlements. They talk about them as resettlements. The president has even referred to them as the Great Return, which is an appalling way to talk about what should be the process in Palestine, as in their colonization process of what they've taken from Armenia. So it's partly about replicating that kind of way of doing politics of the Israelis, which is, you know, you steal land, you settle it, you take it over, make it impossible for it to go back. But also, of course, it's partly about allowing Israeli companies into there, into these areas. This is three regions that the Azerbaijanis captured from the Armenians, which are along the border of Iran. And so they're extremely close to the border. And, of course, the Israelis are in there, really extremely close to the border. And as we saw in the film, the agricultural minister was there, closest any Israeli has openly been to the Iranian border since the creation of Israel. So this is an extension of the way in which Israel does politics in Palestine to regions bordering Iran.
Mm. Well, Kit, I mean, tell us about the arms supplied by Israel, including the so-called Iron Dome, and of course the infamous Elbit systems are involved as well, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, so this is actually a very long-running story. Since becoming independent in 1991, following the dissolution of the Soviet Union, Israel moved very quickly to start arming Azerbaijan, largely in secret, or at least, you know, it was unacknowledged. There are numerous US and British restrictions on shipping arms to Azerbaijan, and that space is filled by the Israelis. So yes, they receive weapons directly from Elbit, which is, you know, a major Zionist weapons manufacturer operating in Britain. Although how much longer for is an open question, given the crusading efforts of Palestine Action. So, following, in April 2016, there was another war between Armenia and Azerbaijan, and Armenia actually made significant advances into Azerbaijani territory. They were beaten back by Zionist-made armaments, such as suicide drones and anti-tank missiles, which were made in Tel Aviv. Baku was so impressed with this performance that they subsequently expressed a desire to purchase Israel's Iron Dome, which is what Israel claims is an impervious air defence system.
David, do you think this cyber centre is just another area for Zionist subversion of Azerbaijan?
Well, yes, of course it is. I mean, as Kit's been saying, you know, the role of Israelis directly on the ground in Baku is in evidence here as well. This new cyber centre is about teaching Israeli techniques of subversion and propaganda, as well as direct cyber attacks, etc., which they've been investing in very heavily. But it's also part of this wider sense that Israel is extending its reach through the region, becoming the regional hegemon, it hopes. But let's remember, of course, that all of this largesse on the part of the Israelis, the selling of arms, also has a quid pro quo, which is that up to 40% of Israel's oil comes from Azerbaijan. So there's a really strong relationship there.
Yes, indeed, indeed. Well, listen, we'll come back to the discussion in a moment after this report about a Zionist indoctrination group that's been active on all five continents, known as the Organization for Rehabilitation Through Training.
In 2009, WikiLeaks revealed a US State Department cable on the relationship between Israel and Azerbaijan. It said Azerbaijan's relations with Israel are discreet but close. It went on to endorse the description of the relationship given by Azerbaijani President Aliyev. Like an iceberg, 9/10 of it is below the surface. In 2019, an Israel-based organization, ORT, announced an ambitious venture with Azerbaijan's Ministry of Education. 100 teachers from the former Soviet Republic visited Tel Aviv in 2019 to learn the latest techniques in science and technology education and apply those techniques in their classrooms back home. But is this a problem? ORT, also known as the Organization for Rehabilitation Through Training, says it is a global education network driven by Jewish values. It promotes education and training in communities worldwide. Its activities throughout its history have spanned more than 100 countries and 5 continents. This sounds innocent enough. But in reality, ORT is a linchpin of Zionist state radicalization and propaganda. As early as 2004, ORT launched a scheme to groom and radicalize young people to enable them to lie about the Zionist entity, described as an online Hasbara campaign as a reaction to the growing number of websites that have appeared since September 2000, which voice anti-Israel and anti-Jewish sentiments. It provides a mouthpiece to react to internet hatred. In 2007, ORT, in conjunction with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, created a website to indoctrinate students in Hasbara methods. Even more notable is that ORT is integrated into the Israel occupation forces. They run training at the Air Force Industry School at the IOF airfield in Tel Nof and train students in drone warfare with arms firm Israel Aerospace Industries. As a result, thousands of ORT graduates serve in the IOF Air Force, Navy, and intelligence corps. After military service, many take jobs in Israel defense industries, including Elbit Systems, Rafael, and IAI. One early public example was Karen Tendler, an ORT graduate who was reportedly the first woman to serve in an IDF helicopter squadron. She was eliminated after her helicopter was shot down by the resistance in the Second Lebanon War in 2006. This footage is of her last flight. ORT is one of many Zionist projects below the waterline of the iceberg, aiming to subvert Muslim Azerbaijan in the interest of Zionist regional hegemony.
David, the VT there delved into this obscure Israel-based organisation, the Organisation for Rehabilitation Through Training, otherwise referred to as ORT. I mean, would you say it's just officially another Zionist grouping, or?
So, I mean, it's not formally a Zionist organisation in the sense that it's not a member of the World Zionist Organisation.
No.
But it is a Zionist organisation in the sense that it's part of the wider movement. It's a member of the World Jewish Congress, which is a Zionist organisation. And also it operates all around the world. You said Israel-based. Well, there is an Israel branch of it, but actually the world headquarters of it is in London, in a building in North London, which it shares with the Community Security Trust, which, of course, we've reported on many occasions on this show. So this is an organisation which is... which comes from, you give the acronym there, and that's an Anglified acronym. Its original acronym is Russian. It's a Russian Ashkenazi Jewish organization, and it's been historically part of the Zionist movement, and it remains part of it, strongly involved in propaganda, as you've seen, but also, you know, perhaps more strikingly, you know, directly embedded in IDF bases and the Air Force bases, training students to how to do drone warfare. So no wonder they are keen on getting involved with the Azerbaijanis so they can teach them similar sorts of stuff. And of course, that's the main problem here, is that they're teaching the aggressive military imperialist tactics of the Israeli state to other countries.
Well, Kit, I mean, the US State Department cable that WikiLeaks revealed in 2009 is interesting, isn't it? I mean, what do you make of the revelation in the cable that 90% of relations between Azerbaijan and the Zionist entity are actually submerged?
Well, yes. I mean, the cable's rife with absolutely remarkable quotes, I mean, which touches on what we've been discussing. Israel seeks discreet but close relations with Azerbaijan. Israel's attitude towards its customer base for weapons is much more relaxed than that of Britain or the US or the European Union. But one of the most striking portions from my perspective is when it discusses how Azerbaijani authorities, quote unquote, assiduously protect Israeli interests in Baku, which means that when there is a large scale protest against Israeli actions, it must be borne in mind that the Azeri population is overwhelmingly Muslim and by some estimates, 96% Shia. When quite naturally the local population voices its anger at Israeli actions, the Azerbaijani authorities will brutally crack down on those protests, you know, viciously assaulting participants, you know, arresting them. This is not an indulgence which is extended to many other of Azerbaijan's allies, perhaps not even the US or the EU, the latter of which it seeks to join. And so, yes, I mean, we see through how its close relations with Israel, Azerbaijan gets a certain level of access to weapon systems it needs to develop its army that it can't get from other sources. And in turn, this increases the utility and indeed the necessity of the Israeli state's involvement in Azerbaijan. This implants Israeli technology and Israeli personnel on Azerbaijani soil. Now, I mean, as with any occupying colonial power, is the Azerbaijani government really going to do anything to upset its patron or client, depending on how you view things? No, it isn't.
Well, David, I mean, the ORT seems to be, as I think you were alluding to in one of your previous answers, directly involved on the basis of the Israeli occupation forces. And it's closely involved, isn't it, with Israeli arms firms like Elbit and Rafael?
So, yes, I mean, they're embedded in military bases and also embedded within the arms firms. So they train people within the arms firms. Then, of course, once they've been trained in drone warfare or whatever else, the technical stuff that's supporting Israeli military adventurism, they then go on to work inside the arms firms. So, obviously, the Israeli arms industries, including Rafael and Elbit, of course, both of which have got significant presences in the UK, and of course, have become a flashpoint for the kinds of actions which have been launched by Palestine Action. So we've seen in recent weeks the occupation in Leicester, and recently the invasion of a Newcastle factory owned by Rafael, which is a new departure for Palestine Action. So there's, again, another very close connection between what's happening in Britain and what's happening over there.
Mm. I mean, an ORT seems to be involved in Israeli Hasbro has been for a couple of decades or so. I mean, how exactly do you think it sort of fits into that whole sort of strategy?
Well, the Hasbro program of the government, or the Zionist government, is a huge effort, right? They had a ministry back in the 70s, and the ORT got involved in at least in 2004, and then more heavily directly with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in 2007. Mm. And that, of course, is part of this whole push that they've made through the Global Forum for Countering Anti-Semitism and various other international fora to merge the ideas of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism and pretend there's no difference between them, and that criticism of Israel is itself anti-Semitism. And of course, that's, as you saw with the VT there, the 2004 effort, the first propaganda effort they were involved in, and again in 2007. They're part of the Israeli state's global campaign against criticism of Zionism and against those who stand up for Palestinian rights. So it's not a surprise, really, to find that core involvement, or indeed actually to find that they're in the same building as the Community Security Trust indeed. In London. This is all part of the same effort.
Yes, indeed, indeed. Kit, I mean, I hope we've still got the link there. I mean, what do you think all this tells us about the Zionist entity's role in the region?
Well, I mean, as I recently reported for Press TV, the Zionists have a wider interest in provoking instability and exacerbating existing tensions between the respective countries. You know, Georgia and Azerbaijan have a very close relationship to the extent that Mikhail Saakashvili, the Western puppet president of Georgia from 2002 until 2012, said an enemy of one of our countries is an enemy of us both. So by turning Azerbaijan further away from Iran, it turns Georgia in turn farther away from Iran, and it is on hand to provide Georgia with the weapons it needs to defend itself in the event that war between Georgia and Armenia breaks out. The two have, to say the least, complicated historical relations, and yes, it's Tbilisi's bond with Georgia. Sorry, Tbilisi's bond with Azerbaijan will always trump its relationship with Armenia. And you know, we see the fruits of this in high-level military training. There is the dispatch of weapons, but there's also a significant amount of financial aid. And this was most profusely given to Georgia following its disastrous five-day war in August 2008 with Russia, which began when Saakashvili, with U.S. encouragement, began striking civilian positions in South Ossetia, which is a breakaway region of Georgia. Investors in Tel Aviv reaped a significant proportion of the government contracts for reconstruction. They enriched themselves and they secured a very positive PR for Tel Aviv in the process. And then we fast forward to November 2012, when Israeli occupation forces waged Operation Pillar of Defense. They brutally attacked, without any provocation, the besieged Gaza Strip, and they killed at least 100 people and injured 1,000 more, among them many women and children. This elicited an international outcry, the world over, and condemnation. And yet there was a large demonstration in support of Israel in the centre of Tbilisi. I mean, it's really quite remarkable. I mean, this all feeds into a wider objective of encircling and trying to isolate Iran and create as many enemies of the Islamic Republic as they can.
Absolutely. Well, listen, I'm sorry, Kit, but I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today, as the clock's beaten us once again. I want to thank our guests, of course, Kit Klarenberg, and our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. So until then, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The U.S. State Department wants to speed up military shipments by embracing a more flexible approach, encompassing entire sales regions. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted the U.S. State Department is seeking to expedite arms sales amid a new age of heightened strategic competition and soaring global tensions, according to a new 10-point plan released recently. although the US government authorized weapon sales and training averaging $45.8 billion each year between 2019 and 2022, the time has come to reassess and adapt security cooperation to meet new and emerging challenges, the US State Department declared, pointing to the ongoing Ukraine conflict and tensions in the Indo-Pacific. According to a Wall Street Journal report recently, the new program comes as the U.S. State Department scrambles to rectify delays in sales to foreign militaries caused by a risk-averse and sluggish system. These issues have resulted in fears that some of America's partners could start shopping for arms from some of America's adversaries, the WSJ wrote, citing unnamed U.S. officials. As part of its plan, the department seeks in particular to save time on the policy approval process by anticipating the demands of Washington's international partners based on the prior requirements of their regional neighbors. Citing the officials, the WSJ noted that the reform intends to make the system more flexible by moving away from selling American weapons on a case-by-case basis. Another point of the plan is to change the U.S. State Department's approach to notifying Congress by prioritizing consultations on critical potential arms transfers and sharpening policies in the field of exporting U.S. drones abroad. Last year, as global tensions soared amid the Ukraine conflict and the Taiwan standoff between Beijing and Washington, U.S. foreign military sales to other governments skyrocketed by 49%, reaching some $205 billion, according to the U.S. State Department. The U.S. also emerged as the main source of weapons for Ukraine amid its conflict with Russia, having committed some $37 billion in security assistance to Kyiv. In recent months, however, U.S. media have reported that Washington was running low on several types of weapons and ammunition, as the military industry was struggling to keep up with demand. Meanwhile, Intercept wrote, since President Joe Biden came into office in 2021, he has described a battle between democracies and autocracies in which the U.S. and other democracies strive to create a peaceful world. The reality, however, is that the Biden administration has helped increase the military power of a large number of authoritarian countries. According to an Intercept review of recently released government data, the U.S. regime sold weapons to at least 57% of the world's autocratic countries in 2022. Since the end of the Cold War, the United States has been the world's biggest weapons dealer, accounting for about 40% of all arms exports in a given year. In general, these exports are funded through grants or sales. There are two pathways for the latter category: foreign military sales and direct commercial sales. The U.S. regime acts as an intermediary for FMS acquisitions. It buys the material from a company first and then delivers the goods to the foreign recipient. DCS acquisitions are more straightforward. They are the result of an agreement between a U.S. company and a foreign government. Both categories of sales require the government's approval. Of the 84 countries codified as autocracies under the regimes of the world system in 2022, the United States sold weapons to at least 48 or 57% of them. The at least qualifier is necessary because several factors frustrate the accurate tracking of U.S. weapon sales. The U.S. State Department's report of commercial arms sales during the fiscal year makes prodigious use of various in its recipients category. As a result, the specific recipients for nearly $11 billion in weapons sales are not disclosed. The regimes of the world system is just one of the several indices that measure democracy worldwide, but running the same analysis with other popular indices produces similar results. For example, Freedom House listed 195 countries and for each one labeled whether it qualified as an electoral democracy in its annual Freedom in the World report. Of the 85 countries Freedom House did not designate as an electoral democracy, the U.S. regime sold weapons to 49 or 58% of them in fiscal year 2022. In Biden's first full fiscal year as president, weapons sales from the United States to other countries reached $206 billion, according to the U.S. State Department's annual tally, which uses an opaque but seemingly broader accounting of yearly FMS and DCS figures. Biden's first year total surpasses the Trump-era high of $192 billion. The multi-billion dollar effort to train and equip Ukraine doesn't fully explain the dramatic rise in total arms sales last year, let alone to autocracies. The Russia-Ukraine crisis didn't occur until 5 months into fiscal year 2022, and much of the assistance from the U.S. to Ukraine took the form of grants, not sales. And the transfer of material from Pentagon stockpiles through the Presidential Drawdown Authority. Rather, the new figures reveal the continuity between Republican and Democratic administrations. While Biden signaled early on that his arms sales policy would be based primarily on strategic and human rights considerations, not just economic interests, he broke from that policy not too long after entering office by approving weapon sales to authoritarian regimes.
Hello, welcome to another Face to Face. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Very happy to be with you today, bringing you this program, this on the anniversary of the creation of CEPAL Pastoral. And I will be talking to Mr. Mohsen Rafiq-Duz, who played an important role in the creation. So we'll be talking about just why was CEPAL created and the role that it has played in the past and continues to play today. So stay with us. I think you will enjoy this program. Thank you so much for agreeing to talk to us here at Face to Face, Mr. Mohsen Rafiq-Duz.
Hello, I'm at your service. I hope we will have a good interview.
Inshallah. What was the reason that CEPAL Pastoral was originally created? Was it because the military was from like the previous regime, or was there another reason for that? What role did you play in the creation of CEPAL Pastoral?
The Imam had not yet returned to Iran from Paris when one of the revolutionaries of that time, Mr. Mohammad Montazeri, who was later martyred in the explosion of the headquarters of the Islamic Republican Party, IRP, in Tehran, came from Paris to Iran and to Refah School. He first raised the issue with me that the revolution is winning, and this revolution is facing the army of the previous regime. He said it is not a problem for the army to remain, but we need to organize a force that will protect the revolution. He stated that the revolution needs a guard and even talked to many people, and many meetings were held in which I participated until the day of Imam Khomeini's arrival. On February 28, 1979, I was engaged in activities in the axis of the Islamic Revolution when I was informed that the Revolutionary Council wanted to meet with me. I attended the meeting. The late Shahid Beheshti announced in that meeting that just now Imam Khomeini gave Mr. Lahouti the order to form the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, or SEPAH, under the supervision of the then interim government. They asked me to abandon all my activities and join the SEPAH. First, let me tell you how the name of the Revolutionary Guards was created. The interim government asked Imam in a letter to allow the formation of the Revolutionary Guards under the supervision of the interim government. Well, we also went to the Abbasabad barracks, which was near the location of the logistic forces of the army, and during the revolution, it was the governorate and military center of Tehran. We saw a number of gentlemen who were mostly Muslim students from abroad came there, of course. Among them were a few Iranians, like Mr. Danish Monfarid. Since I was Imam's driver and I was in charge of the Alavi school, all those gentlemen knew me. When I entered, I sat down, and on a piece of paper I wrote, "In the name of God, the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, SEPAH, is formed," and then I put number one, Mohsen Rafiq Dost, and then I passed the paper to the next person sitting beside me. Therefore, this was the formation of the IRGC. The reason why we created the IRGC at all was that it's been proven to us the necessity of forming a force separate from the army to preserve the Islamic Revolution. Therefore, we thought of forming a force that would protect the revolution from all the surrounding dangers. Later, even in that meeting, we formed General Headquarters while the IRGC itself had not been formed. But we elected General Headquarters. Mr. Danish Monfarid, who was one of the insider forces and one of the friends of Shahid Rajai and those who worked at Refah School, was supposed to be the commander, and I was in charge of the logistics and the necessary tasks, from operations and logistics to information and public relations, etc. Then my work began. I had to find a place for this force and provide facilities, and we started to enroll. As we were forming the IRGC, we noticed that three other groups under the name of SEPAH were being formed here and there. The late Muhammad Montaziri, although the Imam had written the following letter to form the SEPAH under the supervision of the interim government, he was against the interim government from the very beginning. Therefore, he went to the university guard, gathered a group of people around him. Among them were some brilliant figures, such as the late Shahid Kolah Duz or Muhammad Montaziri. They formed a group and named it PASA for short. Abbas Amani, known as Abu Sharif, had also formed a group in the Jamshidiyeh barracks. The late Muhammad Montaziri was in contact with the late Shahid Beheshti there. Abu Sharif was in contact with Mr. Musavi Ardabili and had gone to the Jamshidiyeh barracks along with people like Javad Mansouri, Mir Salim, and Ibrahim Muhammad Zadeh, who were all prominent revolutionaries. On the one hand, we had seven armed groups before the Islamic Revolution that were in contact with the Imam, groups such as Mansuran, Ummat Vahideh, etc. They were also gathered together in a building on Dr. Shariati Street, which was known as D Building. They had gathered there and were doing something similar to us. They used to call us the Saltanatabad SEPAH. They were also active in some areas. For example, they informed us that in a house on Gorgan Street, weapons were collected by the Mujahideen Khalq terrorist group. Well, we issued an order and our troops were dispatched to the location to get the weapons, but suddenly we were informed that Muhammad Montaziri and his team had been there and gathered everything and left. As a person who was older than all of them in terms of age, and I was familiar with all of them, for example, I knew Mr. Aghazamani before the revolution and others. So one day, I invited Mohammad Muntazari, Abu Sharif, and Mohammad Burujerdi to our center, that is the Saltanat Abad Sepa. They accepted my invitation. We had a meeting with them for a few hours. First, I stated that our group was legal because we have been formed by a decree, but you have created your own groups all by yourselves. And I said, I also do not accept many of these people who are there. They are good people and they help a lot, but for the Sepa that we are determined to build, these groups and organizations are not useful. You should all get together and make a core. Our negotiations lasted for 4 or 5 hours. I was even carrying a Colt 45. I took it out and put it on the table, and I said that if today's meeting doesn't work out, I'll kill the three of you first, and then I'll kill myself and make everyone happy. Of course, we reached an agreement. From each of these four groups, three people were selected, and the groups were merged into one Sepa force. I informed this matter to the Council of the Islamic Revolution. They were very welcoming. They assigned the late Mr. Hashimi Rafsanjani to communicate with us. Several meetings were held, and the integration was almost complete, and it was decided that all the forces would come to the Saltanat Dobat Sepa. Among them, in the new round, people like Javad Mansouri became the commander, Abu Sharif became the head of operations, and I remained the head of logistics. I was responsible for the logistics of the revolution since 1963, and I'm still in the same job. Then we prepared this list and took it to the Council of the Islamic Revolution. Let's not forget that the contact person between us and the government was Ibrahim Yazdi, who was the deputy prime minister for the affairs of the Islamic Revolution. The problem was that there were many issues that had to be raised with the interim government, but unfortunately, whenever we requested a meeting, he either didn't give time or postponed it until midnight, so he was usually sleepy during the meetings. In short, we in the Saltanat Abad Sepa decided to take Sepa out of the control of the interim government. Therefore, I went to Rome to visit Imam Khomeini, along with Mohammad Gharazi, who later became the oil minister, and the late Mrs. Dabbagh, who was the commander of Sepa in Hamadan for a while. I was the speaker in that meeting. We told the Imam that we cannot get along with the interim government and have a good cooperation. The Imam asked, "What should we do?" I said that it would be very good if the IRGC went under the supervision of the Council of the Islamic Revolution. The Imam quickly accepted the suggestion and issued an order to put Sepa under the supervision of the Council of the Islamic Revolution. All these events happened in around 50 days. Then we selected some people as the general headquarters and handed them over to the Council of the Islamic Revolution. The Council issued a decree, and on April 22, 1979, the late Shahid Beheshti, who was the head of the Council of the Islamic Revolution, delivered the decree.
I would like to talk about the role that Sepa played in the 8 years imposed war, because it was one that was very active. Can you explain overall the role?
Sepa.
The IRGC, or Sepa, was formed well. That is, all its members were so devoted that they were ready to die for the revolution. Therefore, the works done by the IRGC was great and valuable. I mean, for example, first it put an end to the Tudeh party, and then when it found out that the Mujahideen-e Khalq terrorist group was gathering weapons, it did intelligence work on this terrorist group, and then slowly those concepts settled among the people that the IRGC was to defend the Islamic Revolution and stands against any danger. Because, you know, the history of the Islamic Revolution, at least between 63 and 100 anti-revolutionary groups have been formed, such as the Forghan group, the Iranian People's Fedayi guerrillas, and others. This continued until the Iraqi attack on Iran. Iraq had waged war against Iran based on a precise military calculation. And if it was not for the role of the IRGC and the people did not defend, Saddam would have taken over Tehran after 6 days. Why? Because people have been grappling with the army for nearly 2 years after the Islamic Revolution. Of course, the army leaders were present at the war, and the army's military equipment helped a lot. When the revolution triumphed, the military equipment of the army were almost out of order. I mean, Iraq's Saddam attacked Khuzestan, where the 92nd Armored Division of Ahvaz, which was expected to have cannons, tanks, and armored personnel carriers, had only two healthy tanks. It merits a mention that at the beginning, even the Sepah did not enter the war in an organized manner and under the supervision of irregular headquarters. That is, when the nation felt that an army had entered the country, first of all, the Sepah of Mashhad went in, then the Sepah of Isfahan dispatched forces to the region, and then the Sepah of Tehran. One of the things I did myself was to go to Ahvaz to establish a connection and coordination between these different groups of the IRGC. May God have mercy on martyr Zahir Nejad, who was graduated from a military university. He used to say, if Iraq has 500 tanks, we should have 1,000. We must always have more. As a result, we defended against the enemy's invasion, and we proved that we can drive the enemy out of the country. But when Imam Khomeini ordered that the siege of Abadan should be broken, the army forces that were trained went into action. The IRGC also trained the same popular forces and entered the Holy Defense, and the joint interaction of the IRGC and the army succeeded in breaking the siege of Abadan. This was the first successful experience of defeating the enemy with people's forces that lacked cannons and tanks, while the enemy had everything on the other side. A change was made in the war. Bani Saad was in power, but he had a wrong logic. He was against the existence of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps and its formation and its involvement in the war. And he believed that the war should be managed by the army. And he also believed that we should give land and buy time. In my opinion, he was a spy and a traitor. Mohsen Rezaei, who became the commander of the IRGC, brought good changes to its force. That is, before him, there were just waves of people. But within a short period of time, we had battalion at first, then brigades were created, and then divisions and then corps. If we look back at the Sepah of 1983, we see 20 divisions and 20 commanders in the IRGC, the eldest of which is 23 years old, and one of them is the great martyr General Qasem Soleimani, and other personalities such as Hossein Kharrazi, Ahmad Kazemi, Hemmat, and Mutawassilian. All of these are young commanders against whom Iraq was powerless. A powerful Sepah was created that shone brightly in the war. Of course, we never deny the presence of the army in the war and its effective and influential presence. Many of the army forces were martyred during the war. When the Constitution was being written, many institutions were formed, such as the Martyr Foundation, the Relief Foundation, the Literacy Movement, and the Jihad of Construction, and of course, one of them was the IRGC. The only institution that was included in the Constitution was the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, which, in fact, the Islamic Revolution Corps was in Article 150 of the first Constitution, which states that the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps will continue its role as a guardian of the revolution and its successors. Its limits and duties are defined by law, and that's how the Sepah continued to exist. Well, in the war, as it was known, both the army and the Sepah, or IRGC, carried out operations, both separately and jointly. That is, whenever it was decided that one of those two military branches should carry out a military operation, the Supreme Defense Council would take the plan, and if it was approved, the operation would be carried out. And sometimes we merged. For example, in the FAV operation, since the army commander of the time did not believe in that operation and the Sepah was assigned to perform its duty, all the army's artillery was assigned to serve the Sepah or IRGC. Well, the Sepah had become a powerful force that has a large number of divisions, brigades, and battalions. It has captured military equipment from the enemy. I also provided facilities for the Sepah as a logistics officer, and a ground force was formed. We had also created a naval unit. I had brought a number of boats and light vessels for the Sepah, but overall it was nothing remarkable. Until 1986, when I was in North Korea, I received a call and I was ordered to return to Tehran as soon as possible because Imam Khomeini had ordered the formation of the three IRGC forces, land, sea, and air forces. Of course, the order to form the Quds force came later. Then there was a division of labor between the army and the IRGC. That is, for example, the forces operate regionally in such a way that the IRGC's navy is based in this port, the army's navy in another area. They should help each other whenever necessary. The ground forces of the IRGC could also be divided regionally, but in the Air Force, it was divided in such a way that the Air Force was given to the IRGC, but the Air Force of the Army remained the same.
Sepah has entered different fields. One of the fields that it entered was producing military equipment. I'd like you to talk about that and why that started and how effective it has been.
When we recaptured Khorramshahr, there were two ideas in the country. One idea was to accept the truce. Another idea was that, no, we should continue the war. I agreed with the second point of view. Our reason was that why should we end the war except that we recognized Iraq and Iraq also recognized us? Iraq, from a military point of view, the strategic points of our borders are in the hands of the enemy, and we had only liberated Khorramshahr. Therefore, we had to proceed until the complete elimination of the army and the fall of Saddam. In the end, Imam Khomeini allowed the war inside Iraq after setting very strict conditions. For example, one of the conditions was not to fight inside the cities, where the ordinary people are, and we should fight on the borders. 6 years after the liberation of Khorramshahr, the war continued, until the world was forced to propose the Resolution 598, which was relatively in our favor. The Imam also accepted the resolution under some conditions, but it was actually the best time to accept. This is where the issue of the IRGC's measures to produce military equipment is raised. Why? Well, we were in desperate need of military equipment, so we went to the Western countries. They said they wouldn't sell us weapons. We went to the Eastern countries. They said they wouldn't sell weapons for two reasons. One, the Soviet Union doesn't allow it. And the second, they had already sold everything they had to Iraq. Two countries only, that's Syria and Libya, helped us. Syria itself had nothing to give us, but I went to Syria with some Syrian officers. We went to Bulgaria, for example. They bought weapons from Bulgaria, but in reality, the purchase was for Iran. We would send a ship, and it would change its route, and eventually the weapons would enter the country. It was very hard. Therefore, on the same date, I thought that we should produce our own military equipment inside the country. Therefore, anyone who claims can help, we would welcome it. Regarding our first production, some military forces came and said, as long as we had the TAU missiles, the Iraqi tanks were weak against us and did not dare come forward. But since we have run out of TAU missiles, the enemy tanks are advancing and our equipment don't have the power to confront them. So the first thing we decided to build through reverse engineering was a TAU missile. I invited some university graduates at PhD and master's levels. One of them is still there, Mr. Manoucher Mantari, who is now the deputy minister for the Ministry of Industry, Mine and Trade. I named him the Von Braun of Iran. Von Braun was the one who built bombs and airplanes for Germany in World War II. I took 6 to 7 of them with me to Imam Khomeini. I told Imam Khomeini that I believe that if the alcohol-infected and unhealthy brains of Europeans and Americans can make weapons, these pious and pure young people can do it better and sooner. And that they have promised me that they will build a copy of the TOW missile in a short period of time. The Imam confirmed, and we started immediately. In 1981, when the Ministry of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps was established, I officially established the Deputy of Industries and assigned 18 different groups to manufacture everything we needed, from bullets to submarines, airplanes, and night vision systems. I also formed a group to work in the field of chemistry, microbial, radioactive, or nuclear microbial chemistry. When I went to Imam Khomeini, he expressed his satisfaction with our activities. But when it came to chemical and nuclear weapons, he asked, "What is this?" I said, "These are for chemical, microbial, and radioactive weapons." He asked me, "What is radioactive for?" I said, "It means atomic bomb." He asked with surprise, "Do you want to make an atomic bomb?" I kept silent. He ordered that, "No, you do not have the right to make an atomic bomb." Then he continued that you must not also build the other two, that is, chemical and microbial bombs, but work on building their defenses. When the meeting was over, we all wanted to leave, when Imam Khomeini called me and said, "Do you know why you shouldn't build an atomic bomb?" I said, "No." He said, "Because the atomic bomb destroys nature and human race. And we have not come to this world to destroy nature and human beings. It is a war we have to defend." Now, all these groups that are building advanced military industries today, their foundations were formed during the war. Even during the war, we built missiles with a range of up to 110 kilometers. The defense industries that exist now, of course, the army is moving quickly in the area of manufacturing its military needs too, but we shouldn't forget that the military industries left to us from the time of the previous regime were more like a pot-making factory than a military industry. Now, Iran is one of the three countries in the world in terms of military industries. For example, look at Iran's missile power and industry. We have no competitors in some military fields, and we are the first. Our drones are unparalleled in the region. Perhaps America has drones that we don't have, but we also have drones that America doesn't have.
I'd like to talk about the role that Sepah has played outside of the borders of Iran, and why did Sepah enter that field? And tell me about the effectiveness or the lack thereof of what it's been doing.
Look, our first question is that the Americans are on the other side of the world. What are they doing here? Especially when a crazy president came and openly said that this Saudi Arabia is a milk cow for us. We will milk it as long as it has milk. And when it is finished, we will throw it away. One of the reasons Saudi Arabia has come to Iran very easily these days is that it has come to the truth that it doesn't want to be a milk cow. The IRGC's Quds Force, which is a skilled and active force, why does it operate outside the borders of Iran? Before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the world gathered and said that we should not allow the Iranian Revolution to win. And if it wins, we should not let it rest for a single day. Of course, we won, and they did not let us rest for a single day. Even the U.S. attack on Iraq came because it had found a scapegoat, but it suffered numerous casualties. And then Albright, Bush's foreign minister, announced that we will withdraw our forces from the region and create a proxy force, but he did not give more details. A few years later, Hillary Clinton, Obama's Secretary of State, officially announced that we will build a force in the region at the cost of $4 billion. I had a visit to Pakistan during the time of Benazir Bhutto when I was a member of the Mustaza Fund Foundation. We were building roads in Pakistan. We went there. After a meeting with Benazir Bhutto, it was arranged with the Minister of Roads of Pakistan to go inspect the roads. They stopped at one place. We came down. It was a very big barracks. The Minister of Roads of Pakistan told me that the U.S. government has brought many Afghan students here and is teaching them here. It means that Al-Qaeda is the work of America itself. Something happened to me. It was 7 years ago. I went to Iraq, and it was my first time. On that day, the shrine of Imam Hussein, alayhi salam, was being dusted, and there were some invited guests who were there to clean the shrine. They also gave me a damp cloth, and I was cleaning the floor. I was working when a man came forward and, "Do you know me, Haj Mohsen?" I said, "Your face is familiar." He said, "I am Hadi al-Amri, the commander of Hashdat Shabi." He asked me to tell the Iranians that Daesh was in fact created against Iran. He said that if the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran had not sent Haj Qasem here on the day when Daesh was 40 kilometers away from Baghdad, and we had not obeyed his command, we would never have been able to force Daesh terrorists to retreat to Mosul and then leave the country. If it wasn't for Iran's help, no holy shrine and no Iraq were existent today. Of course, we have entered these countries with the official invitation of the government of Iraq and Syria. It's always been like this for Iran everywhere. We were never aggressors. When we finished our work, we returned. Or if we stayed, we stayed at the request of the official government of the target country. Therefore, we have the right to defend the region where we live. Of course, if the U.S. government learns how to behave with an independent nation and country, we will negotiate with it. But it is highly unlikely. Except for those two, we welcome the rest of the world and we are willing to have a relationship with them. We firmly believe that the future belongs to Iran.
Thank you, everyone, for staying with us for another Face to Face. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Leader meets with Iranian officials in charge of organizing the Hajj pilgrimage. On Wednesday, 17th of May, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, met with hundreds of Iranian officials in charge of organizing the annual Hajj pilgrimage. The meeting took place as we approached the annual Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca, which this year falls between 19th and 29th of June. In this program, we discussed the leader's remarks about the philosophy and the goals of the Hajj pilgrimage, and his points of view expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. With the annual Hajj pilgrimage only a few weeks away, hundreds of Iranian officials in charge of organizing the Hajj and some of those who intend to go on the Hajj pilgrimage this year met with the leader of the Islamic Revolution. At this meeting, Ayatollah Khamenei welcomed the audience and talked about the significance of the annual Hajj pilgrimage and described the Hajj as much more than just a trip, stressing that the Hajj should be viewed as a global issue, an international event, and a civilizational issue in Islamic teachings. The leader added, "Understanding the significance of Hajj is a fundamental principle for everyone, both for the pilgrims and for the organizers of the Hajj. They should understand the significance of Hajj in the Islamic system and as part of acts of worship that people perform. This is very important. We must understand the importance of the Hajj. There are numerous verses in the Holy Quran about the benefits of Hajj. One is Ayah 97 of Surah Al-Ma'idah, which says, Allah has made the Kaaba the sacred house a means of maintenance for mankind. The Almighty regards the Kaaba as being the source of the Islamic community's stability. This is a very important matter. A means of maintenance for mankind. In other words, if Hajj did not exist or if it were not carried out, the Islamic Ummah and the Islamic community would fall apart. Thus, the House of God, the Kaaba, this main headquarters, this fundamental centre, should never be left empty. Ayatollah Khamenei continued by saying, "The blessed ayahs of 27 and 28 of Surah Hajj in the Holy Quran tell us, 'And proclaim the Hajj to all the people. They will come to you.'"